Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I get the argument. It's just wrong. But you know, Keats, I love you.
Well, I appreciate the feedback.
The Dynasty Guru presents Dynasty's Child.
We're not experts, we're gurus. That's different.
With your host, Patrick Magnus.
What loser did you bring to us this week?
Featuring King DeRocher.
Well, I did not know that.
And featuring
Jake, I don't know how to say your last name.
It's Devereaux.
Devereaux?
Devereaux.
Devereaux.
There is no N in the name.
Produced by Adam Lawler.
Hey, you guys. Hey, everybody.
Start over.
Yep, why don't you try that one more time.
Hello and welcome to Dynasty's Child, your flagship fantasy baseball podcast with a focus on dynasty formats. I am your host, Keaton DeRocher, joined as always by Jake Devereaux. And also joining us is a special guest to help us out with the pod today and talk about his top 600 list that he released a little while back, Jesse Roach. So, Jesse, thank you for joining us, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad you're able to make it for the second time to talk about one of your lists. Jake, how are you doing?
Doing well. Just poured myself a cup of coffee, so I am ready to rock. We're recording this at 9:05 a.m. on the East Coast, so... Yeah, it's early, a little bit early, but good to be up and talking baseball.
Yeah, and boy, do we have a lot. We'll get into some of the signings that have happened, some transactions. We didn't get a chance to go over the award races on our last pod, so we'll touch on that a little bit, and then talk about Jesse's list. So. Some maintenance and reminders for you. Any questions for us, you can submit questions on Twitter at Dynasty's Child or via email at dynastieschildpod@gmail.com. So moving right on to the league. Some transactions to review. The Atlanta Braves signed Brian McCann and Josh Donaldson. The Nationals signed Kurt Suzuki. And Minnesota claimed CJ Cron off waivers from Tampa Bay after they DFA'd him. Any of those jump out to you as worthy of talking about in a fantasy perspective?
Yeah, I think a couple of them. Start with the Josh Donaldson to Atlanta trade, or signing, I should say. That's a pretty good one because I think Josh Donaldson has a real chance to rebuild his value there. And Atlanta is a team that's sort of right on the fringe and is going to be able to bat him in a very important spot in the lineup. They batted Nick Markakis cleanup like a shitload last year. So that just goes to show kind of how much they needed a bat like this. I think it's a great contract for both sides, and he could really rebuild his value because the Josh Donaldson that we saw later in the year last year when he finally was healthy was sort of the prototypical Josh Donaldson from a rate stats standpoint. So I'm pretty optimistic about him making an impact there.
I agree with Jake. It's a great situation for Donaldson. Moving to the Braves does impact his value in some small ways, such as moving parks. The Rogers Center is a great place to hit, and the new Atlanta ballpark, there is not a lot of stats for it, but it's still not as favorable. Of course, he's in the middle of a potent lineup with Acuna and Freeman likely hitting in front of him. There's going to be tons of opportunities for RBIs, and I would still consider him pretty early as a top 100 in redraft. And in Dynasty, his value is somewhat static, but with a little more information, he might be trending up as well.
Yeah, I agree with both of you guys. You guys covered that pretty well. One that I wanted to talk about real quick before we move on is CJ Cron. Was this shocking to either of you guys that Tampa Bay ended up DFAing him? A guy that got significant run for them and hit 30 home runs, and then just that they ended up DFAing. Should they have tried to shop him or just retain him for the performance that he ended up having? Was this surprising to either of you guys?
I'll jump in real fast. Sorry, Jake. It was not surprising to me. Righty-righty first baseman. The market is non-existent. And his contract, I think he's probably going to be – well, I think actually the Twins offered with him. I don't know the terms of it, but his contract was kind of going to represent what his value was. Tampa is a rebuilding team. They have options at first base and DH. I think it made a lot of sense, honestly. There was a lot of rumor. The rumor mill was working, and Ian called it for Ian, some common member of the pod, and he called this.
Yeah, I agree with Jesse. not surprising from Tampa Bay's perspective. Like Jesse said, the market is what it is for these types of guys, and 30 home runs just doesn't mean what it means, what it used to mean anymore. And I believe that the contract, and I'm remembering this from the top of my head, but what he ended up signing with the Twins was like $4.8 million. So that's a substantial chunk of Tampa Bay's resources. So it kind of makes sense from both perspectives. And guys like Kroner, guys you can find, and not necessarily guys that anybody would be willing to line up and trade for. So while he is useful to some degree in deep fantasy leagues, he's just not as useful in real life.
Yeah, and go into the Twins where they kind of have a bunch of these guys that they can just kind of rotate. I'm not exactly sure how many plate appearances or chances he's actually going to get to make an impact, barring, you know, an injury or two.
I actually think it's probably a great situation for him from a fantasy perspective. If you own Kron in a dynasty league, he should be thrilled that he ended up with Minnesota. Of course, Minnesota, the park, does suppress power, but it's a young lineup that is up and coming, and you know, I think it's a good spot for him.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking about just the player motion there, because they've got Tyler Austin that will probably get some play. I do assume that they'll move Sano over there at some point. And then it's possible that, you know, our favorite, Astudillo might get over there too. It seems like they have a lot of options.
I doubt that they will play a five, however, what Astudillo, is he like 5'6"?
He's an entertaining bowling ball though, isn't he?
Yeah, he sure is.
He certainly is. Yes.
So moving on to some trades, we have, Terry DePoto working his usual offseason magic. The Mariners traded James Paxton to New York for Justice Sheffield, Eric Swanson, and Dom Thompson Williams. I think that trade actually makes a lot of sense for both. I kind of like that. What were your guys' thoughts on this one? I guess we'll start with Jesse.
I think, you know, the general consensus is that the Yankees fleeced the Mariners here. It's not a super fleecing, but it's they definitely got great value. There's high demand for Paxton in this market. I guess for context, similar value in recent years, someone like Jose Quintana netted Gleyber Torres. He netted Eloy Jimenez and Dylan Cease. It was a great trade for the Yankees. Meanwhile, for Seattle, that Justice Sheffield, he's major league ready, left-handed arm, many cost control years, very good player. There's an open question about whether he can remain a starter. He's not very tall. He's about 5'10", listed. So, you know, that type of size is not ideal for a starting pitcher. Meanwhile, Swanson and Thompson Williams are both interesting prospects. Swanson's more of a back-end starter. He has low to mid-90s fastball and about a couple average secondaries. He could surprise. A lot of people really like him. He put up some really loud numbers in the minors this year. Thompson Williams is more of a power bat, a power flyer. He's pretty athletic. He had a pretty big year last year, but he's really old for the level. It'll be interesting to see what happens with him as he enters upper minors.
Yeah, I think the deal was certainly favorable for the Yankees. I agree with Jesse. I am surprised because, like Jesse said, Sheffield doesn't have a non-zero chance of being a reliever. You know, he is kind of small and he's battled some control issues. So he's not exactly the slam dunk prospect you'd expect back from a pitcher who performs at an ace level when he's on the field. But I think that that last part of it, when he's on the field, is the big reason why this package was relatively light, because Paxton is 30 and he's never pitched over 160 innings in his career. So it's kind of difficult to project him for that going forward. But again, we just saw 180 inning Blake Snell just win the Cy Young. So baseball is trending in a way such that that might not matter all that much. So I think the Yankees did really well here. And it's hard to not take into account that the Red Sox struggle against lefties and that they added yet another good one to their rotation. So it seems like a very division-centric move.
Yeah, could be. And they made another move, the Yankees, that is, trading Ronald Torres to the Chicago Cubs for a player to be named later. And just to run through the rest of them, keep us moving here. Houston traded Trent Thornton to the Blue Jays for Aledmys Diaz. Yan Gomes traded to the Nationals for, I did not write down who the prospect was. And then the larger deal, Cano and Diaz and $20 million to the Mets for a whole horde of prospects, including Justin Dunn and Kalenic. I'm assuming you guys have some thoughts on that last one, so why don't we start with Jake?
So this is a difficult one to figure out. I've gone back and forth like a million times on whether or not I like the Mets side better or the Mariners side better, and I think I finally settled on the fact that I like the Mets side better, considering the money that the Mariners are sending back, $20 million in the deal, plus they're taking on the contracts of Bruce and Swarzak, so I do like it better for the Mets. Diaz's value for fantasy, I don't think has changed. I think that the teams are in very similar kind of areas in terms of their compete window. I think they're both right around the same where they were. I don't think he'll replicate what he did last year, which is a top 10 reliever season ever. But I do think he's going to be great. And he's team controlled through 2022, I believe. So he's got a shitload of control left. From the perspective of Cano, I'm excited about Cano. Even though he's 36 and a lot of people are down on him, I still think there's a lot of fantasy juice to be squeezed out of Cano, especially if he's playing in New York where he likes and if he stays healthy. He's just got such a special hit tool. And I think he can be a productive player and a top 10 option for the next, you know, 3 to 4 seasons. So overall, I really like it for the Mets, and I think that this signals that they are going into compete mode. And from the Mariners' perspective, they got a good haul. I really like Dunn. I think Kalenic has a chance to be a special outfielder as well. He's kind of a five-tool guy, and I'm sure Jesse will tell us a little bit more about him. But and Dunn seems like a guy who could slot into the rotation relatively soon. So I like the deal from both sides.
I agree with Jake. I think that this trade is beneficial to the Mets. It's an interesting move, partly because, you know, what kind of competition window are they in? And they're acquiring Cano, who's has a pretty lengthy contract still. So they have a lot of money tied up in him. The Mariners, they were trying to offload Cano, so they tied their most valuable asset, Edwin Diaz, to him. As for fantasy value, I actually agree with Jake probably 100%. I think Diaz, you know, he wasn't going to repeat his ninth overall in ESPN player rater. That type of performance wasn't going to happen again, especially on a Seattle team that was on the decline. Moving to the NL East is going to be beneficial in a way because he does get to face the pitcher instead of the DH. Now, as to the prospect haul for the Mariners, Kalenic, I'm a big fan of his. He isn't the sexiest prospect because he doesn't have huge power, but he projects to potentially develop a plus hit tool, and he has the frame to add power. At the moment, he's more of a line drive, gap-to-gap hitter, but over time, as he adds more muscle and develops, a lot of people project him to even potentially develop plus power. Meanwhile, he is an above average runner right now and can profile in center field. Should he add more muscle, he may be moving to a corner outfield spot like right field. But he draws comparisons right now to Christian Yelich, and we all know how good he is. So Kalanick is a fantastic player. He is a first-round pick in all prospect drafts that are upcoming. As for Dunn had a nice rebound year this year. He's a former first-round pick. There is a relief risk still with Dunn. He was a reliever in college, at least until his junior year. And it's uncertain whether he will be able to remain be a starter long-term, but it's looking a lot better now. He had a fantastic season, and he should not be ignored. He's definitely a solid prospect, and he should probably arrive at some point later this season. I would anticipate that he returns to AA to start the year.
Jesse, I have a follow-up on Kalanick. One of the things that I've heard as this trade was getting made is that, you know, Kalanick is, like you said, compared to Yelich. Some people even compared him to Benintendi. So he's clearly one of the higher level ceiling guys from a fantasy standpoint in this upcoming draft. But I feel like I haven't heard as much hype about him until this trade was made. So I'm wondering, do you think that he's sort of a little bit under the radar? Because the fantasy guys that I've heard of from this upcoming draft are guys with louder tools like Nolan Gorman. But it seems like, you know, Kalanick at the end of the day might have a chance to be the best guy in this draft based on what everyone's assessment of him was. Because reportedly the Red Sox were looking at Diaz too, and they just had nobody in their system who the Mariners valued anywhere close to Kalanick.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Kalanick. I drafted him in July in an expert mock draft for first year players, including international free agents. I believe I drafted him 5th or 6th overall, and actually a pick ahead of Gorman at the time. I do remain really high on Kalanick. He's a borderline top 50 guy for me. I've gone back and forth on that. It really depends upon how the tools really end up playing. There's a lot of uncertainty because he is really young still, and there is not a large track record. He's a Wisconsin boy, I believe. So as a cold weather kid, he didn't get as much exposure as a lot of other players did. Of course, these days, that the type of Mike Trout being missed by people isn't as common because of the information age, and as this type of as prospects, people are obsessed with them these days, especially, you know, amateur prospects like Kalanick was. He is a fantastic player. I'd say he's easy top 10 in upcoming prospect drafts. Maybe as high as first overall, even ahead of people like Gorman. It really depends upon team need for your fantasy team. I think the top 8 or 9 players are somewhat interchangeable this year, believe it or not. I'm a big supporter of Casey Mize. I know it's not very, it's a minority opinion. you often do not want to be all your chips on a pitching prospect that has had injury concerns, but he's still my number one guy in this draft class, even after Gorman's huge debut.
So of the kind of the bats that came out of this draft, do you think that he has the highest floor?
No, I do not think he has the highest floor. I would say someone like Jonathan India probably has the highest floor because he's a good defensive player and he can play third base. He can play shortstop and second base probably. He's got a high defensive floor and he's a pretty solid hitter. I think a lot of people have mixed opinions about him, but overall, everything is around 55 tool for India. I watched him all spring just about, and from the get-go, I was wildly impressed with him. He was able to drive the ball to any part of the ballpark. He's a patient hitter, and he's a guy that I think is going to move really fast through that system. His debut wasn't loud like some, but don't be surprised if he even makes noise as a potential call as soon as this year.
I don't know if I'm teasing too far ahead here, but you had Kelenic as your 220 ranked player on your top 600, and your outfield, he was number 67 behind Adam Eaton. But you had him substantially behind guys like Gorman and, you know, Tyler O'Neill and Gregory Polanco and some guys like that, Verdugo. Is he a tick below those guys for you, or has that gap closed as you've learned a little bit more about him?
He's still a tick below. He doesn't have Gorman's huge, huge power upside, and Gorman does potentially project to even be an above-average hitter. I've seen reports where they assign a 55 hit tool to him. I mean, something like a 55 hit tool with double-plus raw power is rare. And he actually looked pretty good in his debut in the field, so he may even be able to stick at third base. Meanwhile, Tyler O'Neill has crazy, crazy power, and he's on the cusp. He may even receive significant playing time as soon as this year. I do think he has more upside than Kelenic as well. Meanwhile, Alex Verdugo is also on the cusp. And him ranking ahead of Kelenic is more related to proximity and lower risk than anything. He doesn't quite have Kelenic's upside. So if you are an upside fiend, you probably would prefer Kelenic to him. Yes, Kelenic ranks down there, but he's 50th overall in terms of prospects right now for me. In terms of the top 600, which I'll discuss later, a lot of these tiers can be somewhat interchangeable, and the rankings really do reflect for a lot of it my personal preference of for these players.
Moving on, so last two notes here for this second. Derek Dietrich has elected free agency, and San Diego Padres released Corey Spangenberg and sold Christian Villanueva to Japan. That last one, albeit not, you know, incredibly interesting from a fantasy perspective, I thought Villanueva showed some spurts of being useful last season, so just being sold to Japan was kind of a surprise for me. Even though he was, you know, was probably just a bench guy. Moving on to injuries, one guy to talk about that some people in the TDG Slack wanted us to hit on, Chris Archer. His injury was a procedure to repair a bilateral hernia. The Pittsburgh Pirates announced reported length of his injury is he's expected to require about 6 weeks to recover from this. And Dr. Mike seems pretty positive on his return. He put this on a 2 out of 10 on the freakout meter, and it was perfect timing for the procedure. And he was very impressed with Archer's second half. Dare I say, predicting a bounce back season from Archer, which may have been the most debated player in the TGG Slack over the season last year. So what do you guys think on Archer's chances for a bounce back season? We'll start with Jake.
I like Archer's chances if he gets this issue fixed. I have had hernia surgery myself, and it sucks, and I can't imagine pitching through it for that long. So I imagine that he's going to feel a lot of relief after this. I think he's still young enough that the stuff can sort of rebound and play up. I'm not, you know, one of these people who thinks he's an ace or anything close to that, but a solid fantasy three is something that he could be realistically next year.
Yes, I mean, I still am somewhat optimistic about Archer. He's, I believe, my 43rd ranked starting pitcher. I am heavily discounting some of what happened last year. He is entering his 30s, and you do decline no matter what when you hit 30 years old. And I do think if he does start fast and well in fantasy, it might be a great time to try and swing him in dynasty leagues. He's not a guy who's even been that great over the past few years. So I think a lot of his value is tied to some of his loud strikeout totals of recent memory. And, You know, if those strikeouts are not there, he is somewhat of a, he's a somewhat average starting pitcher. Of course, he's a big name still. So I think, you know, if I owned him in fantasy, which I do not anywhere, I would hold him and hope for a strong start and then swing him, move him immediately.
Yeah, I have him 83rd right now in my rankings. So I guess I have him substantially lower than you. It might be good to play a little game of who would you rather, if you're up for that.
Yeah, we definitely can. Let me pull up our list here. All right, I got some good names here we can work with. So Chris Archer or Carlos Martinez?
Carlos Martinez.
I agree.
Chris Archer or Colin McHugh?
Chris Archer.
Chris Archer or Joey Lucchese?
Archer.
This one's close for me. Probably Archer, just based on upside.
Chris Archer or Steven Matz?
Archer.
Archer.
And this will be the last one. Chris Archer or Robbie Ray?
Ray.
Ray.
That's all right. Those are all guys that performed about the same based on Fantrax scoring for our TDGX2 league. All of those guys were just bunched right there together. So that was a good set of names. I liked it. So we can now move on to our live action reactions. Going over the baseball awards from a couple weeks ago. Topic number one, Christian Yelich and Mookie Betts won the MVPs. Christian Yelich had himself a heck of a year. So do you see 2018 as his ceiling? Or are you expecting some kind of regression? Or do you think that that's more or less his baseline going forward? Jesse, what are your thoughts?
I think the easy answer here is that it is clearly his ceiling. You know, he's a strange ball player. He does not hit many fly balls. This year, he only hit 103, which is about 23.5%. Not for context, only seven other qualifying hitters had a lower fly ball percentage, and most of them are little dink and dunk hitters like Jose Peraza. Of course, you know, like I said, he's never hit many fly balls. He's a low line drive hitter, and he hits tons and tons of line drives. Now, everyone thought that more fly balls was going to drive the long-awaited home run breakout. That was not the case this year. Obviously, he moved to Miller Park, which is a very favorable ballpark, definitely more favorable than Marlins Stadium. But this year, he had a 35% home run to fly ball rate. That is wild. Now, can he sustain that? Probably not. That type of power is really just relegated to Aaron Judge's and Giancarlo Stanton's of the world. They had that rate in 2017 when they both went crazy with home runs. He even led the majors by over 5% in home run to fly ball rate this year. That's just not going to continue. You know, he's got a lot of power, but to expect 36, 35 home runs again is unrealistic. Again, that's a very easy response, very easy answer to this. Of course, you know, if he hit more fly balls, yes, he maybe could hit this many home runs again, but more fly balls would likely lower that sexy 326 batting average. I doubt he's going to change his approach. You know, it wins for him. It works. Obviously, he won the MVP. Even with less home runs, he's still a stud. I do think he's going to still be a 2020 guy. You know, I think Jim wrote a great article back in early September about Christian Yelich, and being a Brewers fan, you should go check that out. Now, he, I think, projected something about 27 to 28 home runs, if you were to discount some of the oddities of his home run binge. Granted, this was in early September, and his month of September was crazy. I think he outperformed just about everyone in the majors that month. So hopefully Jim can maybe update that article and his projection on Yelich moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. I think he is a really interesting player because he had tied his career high in launch angle this season, which was only 4.7 degrees, which is shockingly low for someone of his talent and of his production. So I'd be surprised if he was able to repeat the same power output, but his quality of contact is really impressive, like you pointed out. So he's going to get a lot of hits. He's going to be very productive, but the home runs, I think, is the biggest thing that's going to come back down to earth. I still see him as a top 10 fantasy option for me, just not top 5, top 3 that he was able to produce this season, unless he does find a way to hit more fly balls, which is obviously well within reach.
Yeah, I totally agree with both of you guys. I see him as a 20 home run guy going forward. But everything else is just so exceptional. But like Jesse said, because his swing is arguably the best swing overall, you know, just for the ability to hit for average and all that good stuff in the league, there's just no way that after an MVP season he's going to do anything to alter his launch angle. So this is his swing, and this will probably be his swing for his entire career. You know, and we'll all be happy with it. But I wonder if this sort of built-in ceiling for him that he has because of his launch angle will eventually lead to him being surpassed by guys that have a similar skill set but slightly better launch angle. And a guy who comes to mind is Andrew Benintendi, who's consistently compared to him. And I wonder if Benintendi's, you know, peak, maybe 6 or 7 years, ends up eclipsing that of Yelich because he's got a little bit more loft on his swing.
Big surprise, the Red Sox fan wants Andrew Benintendi to duplicate Christian Yelich's season. I think Andrew Benintendi, I'm still very high on him. I do think that he could develop in a similar way to Yelich. I think projecting something like 36 home runs for Benintendi is very aggressive. I don't think he has that type of power, even at his best. But I do think he could develop 25 to 30 home run power in time. It's really hard to say how these guys develop. You know, at the moment, you know, Benintendi was on pace for a great year until he had an empty second half. I think he slugged about .380 in the second half, and he had only a handful of stolen bases and a handful of home runs. He probably stuck some fantasy teams, and there made some people pretty bitter. But you know, he does have a plus hit tool, and he had that power is there for Benintendi to put up 2020 seasons for a while. Whether that becomes something like a 30-30, unlikely, but maybe, you never know. I don't think he has Yelich's power, but he's still a fantastic player.
Yeah, moving on to Cy Young, DeGrom and Blake Snell were your winners. And so this question is a little bit more straightforward. So of the two over the next 3 years, who you got and why? And
all right, Jake, I'll go with the unpopular opinion here. I have Jacob DeGrom over Blake Snell over the next 3 years. DeGrom is currently the best version of himself. And I think that's what swings it for me. His stuff took a massive step forward last year. His slider, his changeup, and his fastball all ranked among the most valuable pitches in their respective categories in baseball. I think it helps him that he pitches in the National League in a division that, you know, can be considered relatively weak, especially with Harper likely leaving the division, and, you know, us not knowing what the Phillies are going to have right now. And Snell has to go against the Red Sox, Yankees, a Blue Jays team that can still hit a little bit. I think it's just a harder environment that Snell has to go against. And DeGrom just simply has more reps. He knows how to pitch. He knows how to maximize his stuff. And I think that pitchers are a little bit different than position players in that you usually see top-tier elite-level pitchers have their best seasons between, like, 28 and 33. And he's kind of right in that range. So I think that he will be the more valuable fantasy guy going forward.
I disagree, and this is the first time this pod that we've disagreed. So I like Snell out of these two, and mainly because of how impressive Snell's second half was. He made significant gains in his walks and his strikeouts over the course of the second half. He wasn't a guy that was having a ton of control issues, but was able to cut his walks per nine in half over the second half compared to the first half. So just his stuff is so electric that adding in, you know, the more pinpointed control and more swings and misses on his slider is just, he has a chance to put up filthy, incredibly stupid numbers over the next 3 years. And his age is on his side as he's still improving. It feels like DeGrom, like you said, he is the best version of himself now. And Snell was tremendous last year and still improving. And I think he, within 3 years, he will eclipse where DeGrom is producing.
I agree with Keaton. Snell, of course, is 20. He's younger. He's 25. He is one of the few pitchers in the majors that has four plus pitches. That is incredible. His stuff is some of the best in the majors. For context, under Fangraphs pitch values, he has the 16th best fastball. He had the 12th best slider, the 3rd best curveball, and the 7th best changeup last year. That is simply incredible. And as Keaton touched upon, the big question with Snell moving forward is his walk rate. He did make great strides and lowered it significantly last year, but he still has an elevated walk rate. Last year, it was 9.1%. Over the course of his career, it is 10.6%. If that walk rate were to fall to something about 8 or 7%, he would jump to that next level of elite great pitchers. All the top guys have pretty low walk rates. You look at Scherzer and Kershaw and Kluber and all those guys. If Snell were to, he's so young, if he were to improve his command and control ever so slightly, it's just crazy to think what he could do.
I got to push back on you guys a little bit here. So let's talk about some pitch values. Jacob DeGrom had the 4th best fastball in baseball, according to Fangraphs. You had Snell down at 16. From a slider perspective, let's see where they were. Jacob DeGrom, 6th best slider in baseball. Snell, 12th best. From a changeup perspective, we had Jacob DeGrom, 2nd most valuable changeup in baseball. Blake Snell, 7th. Okay, and then DeGrom also has none of the potential control issues that Blake Snell has. So how can you guys project Snell to be better than DeGrom going forward when he has a better repertoire right now and none of the question marks?
Basically, on the upside, he's still improving. So he's not far behind DeGrom now, and he's still improving and has, I believe, a higher upside over the next 3 years, potential upside over the next 3 years than DeGrom. So it's playing the upside and the potential with Snell and his youth over what you have now currently with DeGrom at his peak.
I guess I would argue that Blake Snell's upside is what DeGrom is right now. I don't see how his upside is higher than DeGrom's.
Maybe it is. But do you think that DeGrom is going to sustain this for the next 3 years?
I don't see any reason why he wouldn't.
I'll jump in real fast. One thing you didn't mention, Jake, was DeGrom's curveball, which, while it's still great, it doesn't match up to Snell's, at least not last year. You know, Snell had the 3rd best curveball in the majors last year. DeGrom had the 11th, according to Fangraphs pitch values. Those 4 pitches, you know, if they were to even take a small step forward, because he's still developing, he's not even 26 years old yet. And those 4.5 years is a significant amount of time in which a pitcher does develop. Pitchers don't hit their peaks until their late 20s. And I think that, you know, there is a leap of faith when you were to take someone like Snell over to Grom, just from a general standpoint, because you're anticipating some steps forward while you're also anticipating DeGrom doesn't take steps back. I mean, he's now entering his 30s, and there has been risk with him before. You know, there have been injuries, and as you get older, your body does break down. I think there's some uncertainty too moving forward. Will he stay with the Mets? Will he move? Will he be traded to another team? You know, what is his situation going to even be? I think in Dynasty, you normally will favor this younger player too, because they will have more trade value over a longer period of time, and often that's kind of a tiebreaker if you're looking at two players that are similar.
Yep, points well taken, guys. I think we might need to have our first official bet of the season, Keaton. A Snell versus DeGrom bet over the next 3 years, a long-term bet.
Whoa, all right.
Yeah.
I'm down for that.
Okay.
We'll make note of that. Where did our bet thing went away? I'll just write it at the top.
Yeah, Jesse, we have show bets that we will keep, and then rubbing each other's noses once they are paid out. So it's a good thing.
Sounds like a great thing.
Yeah, this is a long term one though. I guess for the listeners, we're gonna have the show going on at least for the next 3 years now. We've locked it in.
Yeah, we've been renewed for 3 more seasons. All right, moving on, another one that we're going to have some debate on, and I would like Jake to go first on this one. Rookie of the Year, Acuna and Ohtani. And so another simple question, who's the better dynasty asset? So, Jake, I would like you to go first.
Okay, I have some hot takes on this one. This one makes me actually laugh out loud. It's Acuna, and it's not even close. I don't even get the argument for Ohtani here. Ohtani's bat was better than I expected. His pitching was better than I expected. But here's a guy who's going to undergo Tommy John surgery. Dr. Mike was on the podcast with us and said that could impact how much they let him run as well. He's still got a lot of swing and miss to his game. Acuna is everything. Like, I'm doing a dynasty draft right now. He just went 3rd overall, which I think is basically consensus for him at this point in industry dynasty drafts. He's younger. He has a brighter future in every area except for pitching. And I think that Ohtani's problem throughout his career is going to be that his value is limited, because his pitching is going to limit how much he's hitting, and his hitting is going to limit how much he's pitching, and all that stuff is just going to cap his value. And you know, I guess I just don't even understand, because when I'm looking at rankings here, and you know, I'm going off Jesse's top 600, Jesse has him 3rd, which is smart, and he has Ohtani at 36, which is also smart. So the value gap here is immense for me. I don't see this one.
All right, I'll jump in real fast. So you just stated my opinion about these players. Obviously, I do prefer Acuna way more than Ohtani, partly because there's far less risk, right? Because he's an outfielder. He doesn't have the specter of Tommy John surgery recovery looming over him in the foreseeable future. Ohtani also has to split time between pitching and hitting, likely, moving forward. And so, yes, there's a lot of uncertainty with Ohtani. But Ohtani this year was the 22nd rated player on ESPN's player rater. All right, 22nd. And he had bouts of injuries all year long. And it was his rookie year. Just think if he was healthy, right, for a full season and established, and they gave him more time at the plate, and were putting him on the mound every 5 days. I mean, that right there is almost a slam dunk top 10 player. Potentially by far the best player in fantasy. I think his upside is sky high. But the risk is extreme as well. And in the short term, obviously, next year he's probably going to be delayed. He's going to be recovering from Tommy John surgery, and he likely is going to be DHing when he does return, and that's all he's going to be doing, obviously. I do not think he's going to steal at all. He accumulated 8 stolen bases in the last 2 months, and that was basically at the point where they knew he was going to be undergoing Tommy John surgery. So what was the risk? While he's recovering from Tommy John surgery, I don't anticipate the Angels will allow him to run whatsoever because of risk to setbacks. And I believe Dr. Mike Tanner said the same thing. Now, with that said, his upside is just crazy. In daily leagues where you can manipulate your lineup every day to get him in there and maximize his value, he has huge, huge value. He's a high maintenance fantasy player, though. I mean, you're going to have to watch and see what happens every day with him. Now, in weekly leagues where you have to choose whether you want to play him as a hitter or a pitcher week to week, his value is far less. Far, far less, because he's not an everyday hitter. He's not an everyday pitcher, at least at the moment, because the Angels have been using, at least last year, a 6-man rotation. So, obviously, daily leagues normally are more preferable anyway. So, especially with the advent of Ohtani, I think that people will probably transition even more to daily leagues. But with all that said, Acuña is the man. He was an absolute monster in the second half, and the sky is also the limit for him, and he's so young. He's the third overall dynasty player for me, and honestly, I would not fault anyone for even taking him first overall over Mike Trout.
So I think the gap is not nearly as large, and there are a lot of caveats to it. But I actually think, long-term, that Ohtani is the better fantasy asset because of you're getting an elite hitter and an elite pitcher in one player. Now, the first caveat is what platform you're using, and is Ohtani two players or one? Obviously, that is a huge difference, because if, you only have the hitting Ohtani versus having the ability to play him both as a pitcher and a hitter, that's a huge difference, and that's half of his value. But the numbers that he and Acuña put up are remarkably similar this past season, and Ohtani had 100 less at-bats. So he was only 4 home runs short of Acuña's total and 6 steals short. They both hit about .290. Their walk rates and strikeout rates were about the same, and so was their slugging and on-base percentage. But the quality of contact for Ohtani was much higher. He barreled 4% more of his hits than Acuña did. And that drives a lot of success with the outcome of the plays. So if you're in a league where, like Jesse had kind of outlined, where you have daily rosters where you can play him as both a pitcher and a hitter consistently, and you have him as one player, not two, then I think with all those caveats, I think long-term, with 2019 aside, I think long-term Ohtani is the better dynasty asset.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I get the argument. It's just wrong. Keats, I love you.
Well, I appreciate the feedback. All right, moving on to our guest segment, Fantasy League segment, where we get to talk about Jesse's top 600. So we've got some questions for you, and we'll talk about some players, and then get into a little bit of the pod specs at the end, if we have time for that. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But starting off, the first question is, so normally our rankings for our large list is a top 500. So what was the motivation for taking that 100 further?
Well, I rank tons and tons of players, so I figured that why not give our readers 100 more players to look at. Part of it is because of my tiers, and 500 cuts off in the middle of a tier. So I wanted to close that tier off. And so that's one reason why I sent it up to 600. Honestly, I could probably extend even further. You know, it becomes untainable after a time. I think the larger the list, the better product is smaller lists. If you look at it at a positional level, and that's one thing that we do really well, the Dynasty Guru, and those lists will be coming out in January, our collective lists, starting with catchers, and we're working on them right now.
Yeah. So, speaking of that process, what is the process like, and how do you kind of even get started when you're ranking so many players?
So, I talked a little bit about the process on the last podcast, so I don't want to go over the same ground, but I go position by position. I always have. Doing the top 600 was an update. I update my list fully during times where there are no major league stats accruing, where there's more of a static period. Of course, even during that static period, there's transactions and injuries. So nothing is really ever truly static. But I updated during the All-Star break, and I updated as soon as the Major League season ended. For prospects, I update throughout the year, and I started updating the prospects in September. And even as I go through my prospect rankings, which they're coming out every Monday, my rankings are somewhat changing. There's some players that now I have a better view of than I had before, and some other players that are probably going to slide a little bit. But yes, what I do is I do look at position by position. I rank within positions first, and then I fold everyone together. The folding process, it gets aided because I rank players and I assign fantasy tools to every single player. That includes over 1,000 prospects and about 800 major league players. I don't know. I haven't fully counted them. Again, you know, it's a lot of work. And those tools are not static either. They can change over time. They're sort of what I anticipate that player will do at their peak for the most part. And I balance that against the risk associated with that player. But that allows me to help fold especially prospects into major league players by weighing their tools against each other.
So that's kind of leads into the next question is, how do you weight prospects when ranking them side by side with major league talent? Kind of what are some of the factors that you go into determining one's value over the other?
So my rankings initially started out way back when as a measure of trade value in a Dynasty League that I was in, and it was 16-team Dynasty League. I used as close as it can be, an objective measure to weight value of players. That would be prospect picks. So, for example, a 16-team Dynasty League, and there would be a value assigned for an early first-round pick. That would be like a top-5 pick, then a mid-first-round pick, and a late first-round pick. So I was able to, and observing how trades would work in leagues and looking at other people's rankings from those days, for example, Brett's rankings, I was able to flesh out some overall rankings for prospects and for major leaguers. When I started writing for a Dynasty Guru, that whole ranking process was changed and transitioned to a full fantasy grading process rather than a trade value process. So it's actually not too difficult for me to compare major leaguers to minor leaguers. If you believe my grades, there'll be a player, for example, that has 50 hit, 50 power, and 50 risk, and a major leaguer who has 45 hit, 45 power, but 60 risk, for example, and they're about equivalent, right? So the prospect has more upside because that prospect probably will have more be able to hit more and for more power, but also carries more risk because you don't know what their playing time will be. And, you know, they might be on the cusp, they might be in the majors at that moment, but they, you know, are not guaranteed playing time at all. It's somewhat, there's a lot of subjective parts to it, but I try to be as objective as possible. And, you know, for major leaguers, when you look at fantasy tools, part of it is actually just present performance and what they've been doing as major leaguers. You know, once you have years of data, you can kind of get a better idea of who a player is. For prospects, it's sort of just about projecting these players out long term. You know, you will look at you'll look at their present performance, but, you know, present performance only goes so far. You know, you have to take into account scouting reports and what people who've had eyes on these players and what scouts say about what they could be. You know, someone like Leody Tavares, he has been atrocious as a hitter for the most part, but you can't take all of his performance, you know, at face value because he's been so young for those levels and he's still developing. You have to take into account what scouts say. So measuring prospect tools, I think, is a good way of assigning values to these guys and comparing them to major leaguers.
Hey, I've got a follow-up to that. So I think your example of Leody Tavares brings up an interesting question, and that is, when does performance on the field start to trump potential? And Leody Tavares is one of those tricky players that, you know, over the past 2-3 seasons has been ranked very high but has not produced on the field. And you mentioned how young he is for the level and all that good stuff. But at some point, he's going to have to start producing to justify his status as a top prospect and a guy that you actively trade for in leagues. So at what point do you start factoring that in more heavily? Is it double A when that big jump happens between high A and double A? Or, you know, where does that occur for you?
I do think it happens in a way during the upper minor transition. For me, I do like seeing players perform, and I do put a lot of value in that. Hence, I am probably lower on Tavares than a lot of people. However, you know, his ranking by sites like Baseball America and Baseball Prospectus, that is largely based upon his defense. So, you know, he's a high floor guy. You know, these kind of sites, they will give a lot of value to someone who's like almost a slam dunk major league player. You know, I think Keith Law a few years back ranked Kevin Newman in the top 20 because he was basically a slam dunk major leaguer. Obviously that doesn't matter at all in fantasy. You know, regardless, you know, whether someone's a major league player or not, you want someone who can make an impact for your fantasy team. Now, for Leody Tavares in general, you know, he is still very young. I think this year is going to be a big year because he's going to be moving to double A. So, you know, if he continues to struggle this year, he probably is going to be dropping out of my top 100. I'm always looking for the newest information, newest eyes on from people. And, you know, people still are high on him to a point. You know, I think that expectations have been tempered. But overall, yes, I do agree that once someone hits double A and triple A, and if they are struggling or if they take steps back, those are warning signs because pitchers at that level are more similar to major league quality. You know, they can sequence, they have more than two pitches. Hell, they have more than one pitch. You know, so I think that it has been concerning that he has struggled at high A and low A, but I'm still giving him some leeway. I know that Brett Sayer is higher on him than I am, and a lot of people are. I think I have him ranked 91st overall among my prospects. I'm trying to hedge against what his floor is versus what his ceiling is. Who knows how a lot of these guys will end up developing, but for now, I'm reasonably optimistic, but I'm holding it back.
So that's actually kind of similar to where I wanted to go with my next question, and weighing breakout performances versus larger sample sizes. And a guy like Mike Fultonevich, who you have in your top 100 at number 98, he's 27 years old. He's got five seasons here in the majors, and we've got four that are relatively mediocre to poor. And then this past season was a major breakout season for him, where he had 183 innings, which was the most he'd ever pitched in a season, over 200 strikeouts, sub 3 ERA. So how much do you weigh breakout seasons like that over larger sample sizes of mediocrity in some of your players?
I think breakout seasons happen. You can't ignore them. Players will come out of nowhere sometimes if they make just one small adjustment. For Fulte, it really was the progression of his slider. It went from a average, slightly above average pitch to elite this year. He's always had fantastic stuff. He's always been an upper 90s pitcher. He's had decent control for someone who throws that hard, about average. He does have four pitches. And now that one of the other pitches has become elite, I believe in his breakout in a way. I don't know. I think that he does still carry risk, obviously. Despite throwing a mean fastball, it doesn't necessarily have a ton of success. He does not have the best command and control either. But I do buy his breakout. I think that this is a guy who last year had, one elite pitch in the slider. His fastball is what it is, 96 mile an hour fastball that can touch 100. And he also has two other solid pitches. His curveball has been pretty steadily solid, and it's made progress over the years. Now it's profiling as an average to above pitch, and changeup is as well. So we're looking at a guy who has four pitches that are average or above, and at least one pitch that is plus or better. And he's entering his prime. I think that someone like Fulte, who has this raw talent, it can take time. It can take time for players that have huge, huge tools to actually coalesce into something usable at the major league and fantasy level. Some of these guys never actually, develop. Someone like Tyler Glasnow, you saw last year him starting to put the pieces together. He has all of the necessary elements. He just needs to figure it out. Baseball is a crazy, tricky sport. It's my favorite sport. I think it's the best sport in the world. It's one of those sports that, like golf, there's a lot of a cerebral element to it. I'm sure Trevor Bauer fully agrees with me on this issue. But it's rare that someone will be ready to perform at the major league level at 20 years old, 21, 22 years old. I remember when I was that age, I was a baby back then. What Juan Soto's doing and Ronald Acuna's doing, that is just a rarity. So I do buy breakouts when they can happen at age 27 if they're supported by something tangible. And in terms of Fulte's case, I do think there's something tangible here. I think that the progress of his breaking balls, and especially the slider, is responsible, and I think that that can be maintained.
All right, so we've got a couple more guys to talk about before we wrap up. We went a little bit longer than we anticipated, but that's good because it's all been good content. Patrick has a write-in question. he wants to, he's calling you the Ossidio Grinch, and he wants to know why you hate him so much, and are you able to rationalize your hatred for this big lovable man who has taken the hearts and souls of baseball fans everywhere?
Yeah, I would say that I am beginning to slowly come around to Ossidio. I think that my biggest problem with him, all right, first of all, I guess for background, Ossidio is an unorthodox player. He makes contact at crazy, crazy levels. He basically swings at everything as well. You know, he never walks and he never strikes out. Last year, he struck out 17 times in 414 plate appearances, but he also walked 12 times during that period. He is an interesting guy. He's also 5'9". He's listed 5'9", 225. And I would highly recommend any of the listeners to go search for videos of him online. He is a fun player to watch. With all that said, you know, prior to this year, he was just an empty high average hitter throughout the minors. This year in AAA, he exploded with 12 home runs, which was near, and then three more when he hit the majors. You know, that 15 home run season is two home runs less than he previously had hit between 2009 and 2017. Whether you buy that power breakout is an open question. I don't buy it fully. Now, with that said, I do think his hit tool is excellent. I think it's above average, and it even could be plus. Right now, Steamer projects him to hit 291, 320, 442, and to get 403 plate appearances. All right, if you buy Steamer's projection, he's an easy top 10 catcher. I mean, he might even be a top 5 catcher. Now, I think my biggest concern, and I've been beating this, I've been saying this over and over and over again, is where is the playing time? Where is it? They have Jason Castro coming back. They have Mitch Garver at catcher. Their catching system situation is pretty crowded. You know, Castro's paid $8 million a year. They're not going to not play him. Meanwhile, Sanu's back at third base. They just signed CJ Cron, though, like I said before, I don't think Ossidio would play first base. They do have an opening at second, and he has played second before. But as you can imagine, he's not a good athlete at 5'9", 225. He's not good in the field. He's a huge detriment at third and second base. Now, he's actually a decent catcher. I think he could be an average catcher. But, you know, I just don't know where the playing time is going to be. And, you know, I know that there's hitters will find playing time. You know, a batter will get his playing time. But I don't know. I don't know. And even if he does get playing time, what's he going to do with it? Will he just be an empty average guy? Or will he actually hit for some pop? I don't know. I think it all depends upon cost. If he is cheap, which he may be, then yes, definitely worth a flyer. But if he's being viewed as a top 10 dynasty catcher, then no way. No way. Now, for me right now, I think I had him ranked 30th on the top 600 as a catcher. I may have been a bit low on him in retrospect. And I am going to be doing an article when all my prospect lists are complete, entitled "Upon Further Review, Notable Grade Changes." And he is an early part of that, I believe. Him and Evan White, who I'm also think is going to be better than I had him. So, yeah, I don't know. He's an odd one. He's really fun, though.
All right, I got to ask my next question here. I like that you've come around a little on Ossidio, and I'm hoping that you've come around a little on the ineptitude of one Yoan Moncada. I wanted to ask you how you can justify having him as high as you do in your ranks. You have him 57th over a guy like Matt Chapman, And for instance, I would have him somewhere between 90 and 100 on your list, simply because I'm not so sure I believe in his approach at the plate, and we haven't seen it yet in the major leagues. So how much more time are you going to continue ranking him where you are?
So first of all, on my initial draft of my top 600, I ranked him 65th. And then Brett Sayer wanted him in the top 50, so we compromised, and I moved him up about 8 spots. So obviously Brett is even higher on Moncada. I think the tools are all there. They're still there. He still has massive power. I think he's still the speed. He still has tons of speed, even if it isn't translating right now. I think that people who are on his bandwagon still, they believe that eventually the power will fully manifest in games as his hit tool continues to develop. He has plus raw power. I think that the big question is whether he's going to hit enough. I mean, he struck out 217 times last year. I've said this previously somewhere, I don't remember where, but part of that, those strikeouts were approach based. They're not because he's swinging and missing a ton. I mean, his swinging strike percentage is 12.2%. His contact percentage is low. It's only about 70%. But part of it is just he doesn't swing much. He's probably too patient. And that worked in the minors. He regularly walked over 13% of the time in the minors. In the majors, last year he walked 10%. I think he needs an approach change to try and be a little more aggressive at the plate, honestly, and try and hunt for his pitches to hit. I think if he were to fully actualize what he can be, I think that he could develop into something like a 50 hit guy with plus power, double digit, maybe 20, maybe even as many as 20 stolen bases. 20-20 guy at second base is rare. You're not going to see many of those. So I do remain high on him. And I actually think, if he does really, truly develop the way he could develop, he could hit 30 home runs a year. He's still only 23 years old. He's not going to be turning 24 until late May. I would not give up on him. Now, if someone still views him as a top 50 player or even higher, I believe that Jim selected him 21st overall last year in TDGX2. If someone thinks he's that good still, then you should trade him immediately to that player, to that owner. There's still so much upside with Moncada that I wouldn't give up on him. Now, as for Matt Chapman, I love Matt Chapman. Love him. And I actually had him higher before he got knocked down a little bit. Matt Chapman is one of those players who is an amazing real-life player because his defense is otherworldly. Offensively, I actually don't think he can maintain that kind of batting average that he even had last year. I think he's not a 270 hitter. I think he's more of a 250 guy. But I also think he will hit for sizable power, probably maybe even more than he did last year long term. I do love Matt Chapman, though. So I wouldn't blame anyone for preferring Chapman to Moncada. But I do think that Moncada plays second base, which these days is extremely shallow. It's probably more shallow than shortstop. It's not obviously not as shallow as catcher, but if he develops what he can or could, then we're talking about potentially the best fantasy second baseman in baseball. So definitely too early to go up on him.
I have a quick follow-up to that just based on Matt Chapman. So one of the things that I've had trouble with this offseason while we've been ranking is differentiating between that group there that we have under the top tier guys of Matt Chapman, Rafael Devers, and Eugenio Suarez. I have them Chapman, Devers, Suarez. You had it Chapman, Suarez, after Devers. So you had it Devers, Chapman, Suarez. Can you talk about that process for you? What differentiates those three guys? And why did you decide to go ultimately with Devers above the others?
Well, I guess, again, it's partly because of Brett. I had Devers ranked a little lower initially, and Brett kind of beat the desk on Devers and had me convince me to move him up. Now, Devers is just 22 years old, all right? Well, he just turned 22. So there is so much potential still with him. You know, this is a guy who could develop into an above average hitter with plus power. All right. That is a hugely valuable player. Plus he's so, so young. I do think, and as you mentioned, I do think there is a lot of potential for ranking these players in any order, you know, if you extend it to Andujar, maybe four guys that could potentially be interchangeable. Now for Suarez is just one of those streaky players that I think if he doesn't streak at some point during the year, he could really not perform much for you as a fantasy, for your fantasy team. I mean, if you look at his second half, he kind of fell off a cliff. Now Chapman is the up and coming. I think that he's one of these guys that is underrated still. You know, he's underrated all over the place. I think that he'd be a guy that I would try and target in trade. You know, if an owner thinks he's like a 100th or so ranked player, then you should go after him. You know, these three guys, I do think that you could rank them in any possible order. You know, overall, though, I do prefer Devers and Chapman to Suarez, partly because of their youth and just partly because I am concerned about Suarez long term in terms of whether, you know, if he doesn't streak, if he's just if his performance is more steady, then, you know, he's not going to be one of these elite guys. You know, we know what he is, too. You know, for Chapman, the sky is still bit of the limit. You know, he only hit 24 home runs. I think there's easy 30 home runs in that bat. He's got big power. And Devers too. You know, I think there is risk that Devers doesn't stay at third base long term though. And as a Red Sox fan, I'm sure you are well aware of his defense. But yeah, these three are they're all fantastic dynasty options. But yes, they can go in any order.
I actually wrote a what to expect from Matt Chapman 2019 and beyond piece for the Dynasty Guru a couple weeks ago. So if you have more curiosity about Matt Chapman, you should go check that out. Jake, do you have anything else for Jesse? We've gone quite a bit over what we had anticipated. So I'm ready to wrap up if you do not have anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I could chop it up with Jesse about this list for the next 2 hours, so I think we should probably stop it here. But just overall, I'm very impressed with the list, and I've done my own rankings of, you know, this many players, and I have had very little difference between my rankings and Jesse's, so I'm pretty impressed. I think he's done a fantastic job with this, and I can't recommend it enough to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely something you need to check out. All right, so this has been Dynasty's Child, part of the Dynasty Guru website. I have been your host, Keaton DeRocher. You can find all of us on the Dynasty Guru, where the last piece I wrote was about Matt Chapman. Jake, you mainly just do rankings, right? But you've got some stuff going on at Over the Monster.
Yeah, I've got a piece up there on Yasmani Grandal right now. So go check that out. And I've got my other podcast, the Red Seat Red Sox podcast, over at Over the Monster. So check that out as well. But I will continue to be here at the Dynasty Guru doing this podcast and working on rankings and arguing with Jesse about second baseman.
Awesome. And Jesse, what is up next for you in your rankings and releases?
Well, on Monday, we will be I'll be releasing the top 40 fantasy third base prospects, nearly complete right now. And over time, I think my schedule's up, and you can, if you look at any of my articles, they'll have my schedule for the rest of the year. It's subject to change because it is a bit aggressive. After third base prospects, I'll be tackling shortstops and then outfielders and then pitchers. So lots of content coming your way leading up until the new year.
Excellent. You can find all of us on Twitter as well. Patrick is at the Green Magnus. I am at the Spoken Keats. You can find Jake Dev at Dev Jake. And Adam, our producer, you can find him at the Statcast Era. And Jesse, you can find him at J.A. Roach 6. So that is going to do it for us. Have a wonderful day and weekend. And, actually, one note. We're not entirely sure about what schedule is going to look like for December. We'll probably get another pod out. We're just not exactly sure when. So we're going to play it by ear. But assuredly enough, we are still going to be continue podding throughout the offseason. So with that, be the best bird dog you can be.